Good evening.
Good evening.
So, a few months ago, maybe even a year, as much as a year ago, my wife and I and some friends had some dinner in a restaurant in downtown Longview. And it was early evening, and we were driving home down on Middlefield, that way, and the air was very smoky and hazy, you know, very thick, and I thought maybe there's a fire somewhere. It's very, very smoky, and the haze was so thick that you couldn't see the sun, which you could normally at that time of day. Very hazy, but when we turned a corner, suddenly, through the haze, I could see the sun. Not directly, but I could see a brilliant red circular shape through the cloud. Clear, very clear circular shape, very, very red. It was vivid, very vivid. It was kind of spectacular, and you could look at it. You could see the sun in the back of all the hay. You could see it. This is a really beautiful. It occurred to me that this is the only way to look at the sun. This is the only way to really see the sun. Because you can't look at the sun directly. You know, we can't do that. It hurts, damage the eyes to look at the sun directly. Because, you know, our eye does not have the capacity to look at such brightness. If we want to see the sun, without having to turn away. If we want to see the sun, we need the haze, and we need the fog, so we can see it. And then I thought, well, you know, in the same way, our mind cannot see reality directly. Because our everyday mind, our ordinary mind, does not have the capacity to look directly at reality. Our mind does not have the capacity to see our true nature directly. Just like looking, not being able to look at the sun. So the ordinary mind, that we call it everyday mind, or discriminating mind, you know, it knows very well how to think, and it knows very well how to store ideas and store memories and store impressions and to create things and to make discoveries. But the true nature, to see true nature, is beyond the reach of our mental activity. Just as the sun is beyond the reach of our ordinary vision. And yet we desperately want and need to express our true nature, to express reality with our life, so that our life can be real, so that our life can be authentic, and to live in accordance with reality. And so how do we do that? How can we do that if our thinking mind cannot see reality directly? So of course, our practice, the answer of course is our practice. Our practice is for us to stay aware, pay attention, and reflect on what is immediately in front of us, on what it is that we are experiencing in each moment. What we experience in terms of the sensations and emotions and feelings of our everyday life, of ordinary things, of ordinary mind. And when we experience the difficulties of our everyday life and the suffering that comes up all the time, continuously, without a warning, when the experience of difficulties and sufferings arise, we feel that we are far away from the truth, or far away from our true nature. Because at that time, when the grief arises or the difficulties arise, all we can feel is that we are confused and pained. But when we learn to study ourselves through the haze of confusion and pain, when we can accept these feelings without resistance, in other words, by watching the workings of our mind without emotion, and being patient when the suffering or the discomfort does not diminish quickly. When that happens, if we can have that patience, then we can understand ourselves and the nature of our life and the nature of reality. So, we come here to learn to practice along with confusion and suffering. So actually, our practice is allowing ourselves to be confused. To understand that it is okay to be confused. And to trust that there is purpose in it, depending on our attitude. There can be purpose in it, depending on our attitude. And so our life will constantly give us problems and constantly involve us in something we don't fully comprehend. This is the nature of our life. And when we first start to practice, we feel that deeply. It seems that our life, when we start to practice, it seems that our life has become more anxious about confusion. So we, of course, don't like confusion. We don't like pain. We don't like uncertainty. And these are what are known as weeds, the weeds of our life. A small mind the workings of the small mind that we don't like, that give us problems. So we start our practice slowly, not expecting too much too fast. And we try to continue our practice with calmness. And we allow our mind, the mind that desires clarity, we allow our mind to coexist with confusion. You know, that doesn't go away when we first sit down on our cushion. We allow our mind to coexist with this confusion. So the basis of Zen practice is, not generally appreciated. The basis of Zen practice is that confusion helps us. And we learn this over time. And in the well-known Genjo Koan, the Dogen says, people hate to see flowers fall, that they do not like weeds to grow. This is the usual way that people feel. This seems the natural way to feel. Disappointment when flowers fall. And impatient when weeds grow. But as we learn, by way of our practice, we enable weeds to become like compost that we can put back in the ground to provide the nourishment for the plants that will grow. This is a fundamental point in our practice that Suzuki Roshi pointed out in the lecture. We let our weeds become compost, useful compost to provide nutrients. In other words, our suffering can be used to reveal enlightenment. So, Zen practice, it was not established to provide answers to our personal everyday problems. Practice is really the effort we make to understand the nature of our difficulties, to know the nature of things, not to solve problems. And at first, when we start practice and we make this effort, it's very uncomfortable. Something very new. Have to get used to it. Have to trust it. But when we continue practice, and don't give up too easily, when we continue practice, we welcome the effort that it takes. And we learn to avoid seeking for comfort. So when our practice becomes more important than our comfort, then our practice has become wisdom. Because if we practice only when it is easy or only when it is comfortable, that's not practice. Avoiding discomfort or avoiding confusion is not spiritual practice. It is just a way of chasing after comfort. And it is a kind of greedy idea. And a greedy mind can never be comfortable. Sometimes someone who is new to the practice, maybe they come on an introduction day, and many questions are asked. Sometimes someone will ask, is it necessary to suffer to find wisdom? Or is it necessary to suffer to find peace of mind? And that, of course, feels like a very natural question. And Buddhism seems to imply that suffering is required. But that question, you know, is a kind of mental algebra. It's assuming that there is an equation that says suffering equals wisdom, or suffering, like a chemical reaction, you know, suffering transforms into wisdom. And if we see our difficulties in that way, if we see our suffering and its relationship to wisdom in that way, then we start thinking about making a trade-off. We might say, well, what if I don't care so much for wisdom? Can I avoid suffering? Of course, this is a dualistic thinking, because in Buddhism and in our practice, there's no choice. There is no trade-off. If we think there is a trade-off, this is a misunderstanding of our life. So the truth is that suffering is inevitable because we are alive. We have no choice. Suffering will occur. Difficulties will take place. There is no avoiding it. As much as we may try to defend ourselves against it or protect ourselves by hiding out or creating wealth or something like that, withdrawing, we don't have a choice. We are alive, and difficulties and suffering will occur. And it's because everything changes as quickly as the wind. And our everyday mind is not as flexible as the wind. And so the everyday mind suffers because it is left behind. So the point really is, how do we respond to this suffering that's going to come up, or that maybe we are in the midst of it? How do we treat it? How do we understand it without relying on algebra? Or questions like, why did this happen to me? How we respond to suffering is an important point. So if we, when we practice and we learn to accept our life fully, in other words, to allow ourselves to exist in the midst of the unknown and in the midst of whatever may arise, then our mind can be like the changing wind. So when we practice, along with the pain and the discomfort that arises, and we see our responses and we see our mind, we can understand what we are made of. What we are made of in the usual sense. But when we practice with that attitude, we also understand that there is no thing to see. There is no mind to see. There are only the qualities of something very vast. And through the haze of life's difficulties and confusion, we can see some color and some shape. We cannot see the sun, we cannot look at the sun, but we know it's there. When we speak of practice and we speak about what it is or what it is supposed to be, we usually emphasize watching the movements of our mind, paying attention to the movements of our mind. But our practice is not only the awareness of the mind's activity, you know, of feelings and emotions. Our practice also includes noticing our physical behavior, being aware of the words we use, being aware of our body movement and our facial expressions, and our eyes and our hands. They reveal our attitude. Our physical behavior is a snapshot of our mind, so we pay attention to our physical behavior as well as to our mind. Being aware of our physical activity can answer such questions as, am I at peace? Am I relaxed? Am I confident? Or am I grasping? Am I defensive? Am I struggling? Am I suffering? Our body can answer such questions. Even when the mind is struggling with such questions. So we pay attention to our physical activities as well as our mind. So, with a little bit of experience, we all come to realize, we all come to recognize that practice enables us to see our difficulties and our sufferings. And our practice also enables us to come to rest with them and to see the quality of our true nature.
Does anyone have a question tonight? More.
Last lately I've been feeling very attached and feeling a lot of attachment and a lot of distraction. And after listening to your lecture today, I came to the realization that I need to strengthen my practice and start coming even more in the morning. Thank you.
Yes, Kim.
I'm going to take a key off of that. What is it when you really practice in times of difficulty, but in good times, practice is not as intense, is not as consistent, undisciplined?
So are you asking why?
I think I'm saying I'm noticing this.
So you're saying that you notice that we practice fairly intently when things are not so good, but we back off somewhat when things are going okay.
It kind of sounds like I've got a reason for practice, doesn't it? I'm looking for something.
Oh.
I want to get something fixed.
Oh.
I want something to stop. I want to be on top of it again and that.
Okay.
Okay, let me answer my question. Practice seems to be self-correcting. If I go through that, I do notice what I'm doing as I'm going through that. I notice that I'm trying to get over some angst or something. And when that angst is not there, I've got other things to do.
So it means that you see practice as one of many ordinary activities.
Not the other activities aren't of equal stature.
Practice is not the equal stature as other activities.
That wasn't the right thing to say, but it's always there. It's always there. I may not practice. Well, I practice. I may not sit every morning when things are going well, but when things don't go well, I'm sitting every morning.
Okay. Well. So when things are going well, is your mind saying, I don't need this?
I hate to say yes, but that may be part of it. Not, I don't need that. I feel uncomfortable saying, oh yeah, that's exactly what I am, because I can be distracted.
Is it, you're saying that you're using practice as a medicine?
As a what?
As a medicine?
It's far more than that, because practice to me is self-discovery, ultimately.
No, but the way that you're defining it, it almost seems, it comes across that people use it as medicine.
Well, I don't know about anybody else, I guess I'm just talking about myself. Okay. But I know that practice does have that effect on me, not of medicine, but of resolving issues that are going on. That isn't the only reason I do it. I don't walk around and say, oh, I'm in pain today, therefore I'm going to sit for 5 hours. I don't do that. But practice, you know, it's a big time. It can't be put into a box and say, this is it.
So, can I make a suggestion?
Please.
Instead of seeing practice as a way to solve problems, see it as the way to build character, which means it makes no difference if there's a problem or not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Megan.
It seems to me like practice doesn't necessarily build character. You know, like Richard Baker, who ran the Zen Center, it didn't seem to me like he had character, yet he meditated. Like, that you need to do more than that to build character.
Yes, yes. Yes, it's not just sitting on the cushion. There's an attitude that has to go with it. There's you have to be inspired. You know, Suzuki Roshi said many times it's about building character. And it's not just about sitting on your cushion as a kind of duty. You have to carry an attitude with you all the time that says, I'm going to practice in every moment. Not just here, but everywhere. It's when we lose that attitude that we fall into difficulty. Yeah, practice is more than number of hours on the cushion. Thank you. Lee.
I just wanted to say thank you to people for sharing these things, because it takes a little bit of courage to share them publicly, and I think we all go through these uncertainties about our practice. I know I do. And the only thing that I can say is that lately I found that, you know, when I try to get away from the practice, my mind just recognizes it, and I can call it on myself and see that happening. So then now I have to face up to me, you know, sitting there and judging me. So it seems like it's quite a process, but there's more awareness when I'm trying to avoid something, or there's more awareness of my own attitude towards events that happen. You know, if I see some cowardice in myself in handling something, I call it. And so I either have to handle it or I have to know that I was a coward. So it's so interesting. It's such an interesting process.
Yes, thank you. Well, thank you for pointing out. That people are willing to share. It's important because it shows trust. That we trust each other. And the more we do that, the closer we come together, and the more we feel like a real community, like a real Sangha, that we can rely on each other and trust each other. Thank you. Yes, Richard?
Well, at the beginning of your talk, you talked about looking at the sun, how the fog or the smog was actually helpful to be able to perceive that. As far as, like, being willing to be confused, or willing to suffer, the way I think about it is like I'm already confused, and I've noticed that, I'm aware that it doesn't. Maybe I'm willing, or that word, I don't quite understand where. If I notice something, is it intruded, or was it there all along and I just didn't know it?
It was there all along, and you knew it all along. But, you know, this ordinary mind has a limited capacity to see things. So it sees things in sequence or one at a time. And it gives us the impression that we are just discovering something new for the first time. But beyond the capacity of this ordinary mind to recognize things, we know that everything is there. But we know it in a different way. So, if you see a bird, new bird, or a new kind of lizard, you know, for the first time, you say, oh, I've never seen that before, but I'm seeing it because I know it's there. This cannot be explained, but this is our life. So when you see a new bird or a new flower or a new animal for the first time, you say, hello, old friend. Because it was always there. Thank you. Yes, please.
I'd like to just share a little thing about the wheat. You said people don't like to see the weeds grow, and I'm a gardener and I read that weeds are plants. Their virtue has not yet been discovered. I like it.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you. The virtue of weeds has not yet been discovered. Thank you. Yes, please.
Could you say something about how there is a sense of blame or accountability against and how that may impact? I want to say this. I notice that I have a sense of accountability about something I've done, or a sense of guilt or blame, self-blame about something I've done, it affects how I practice and my willingness to be with my suffering, if that makes sense. And I'm less willing to be with it if I have a higher sense of blame or guilt about something. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to that balance between being responsible for your actions and but not being overly responsible, if that makes sense.
Having a sense of responsibility about the things we do in life and about the things we feel we have to take care of. That sense of responsibility brings confidence. Sometimes it's a little stressful, you know. Sometimes we count them and we say, I have too many of those. But they bring a sense of ourselves. If we avoid responsibility, we can never be at peace. But having a sense of over-responsibility, it's important, of course, to know that there are some things we can't take care of. They're beyond our control. or things are changing so fast beyond our recognition of them that we can't take responsibility for what happens. So sometimes we do have to put a limit on what we should allow ourselves to be responsible for. And it is important for, you know, like for our own sanity to know where that line is. We can't be responsible for everything. Sometimes it's just too big or just too distant. So there is a balance. And we just have to rely on our experience and intuition to tell us where to be responsible and where to draw the line. It can be a big question, a big dilemma. Thank you.